All right, so what do we got to talk about here? We've got the origins, that interview, like, really, what the fuck is the story and tone here? What other shit do we want to cover?
Maybe just the...
Inconsistent magic.
Yeah. Inconsistent magic
is
or realism.
Is it the crab? Is it the earrings?
What's like, the magic?
No, it's internal. Where you don't get it.
It's
She's not
magic
a witch.
Also. It's a force. It's the force, not the force.
Midichlorians.
Yes.
It's midichlorians.
This did come out the same year as Phantom Menace.
That's
so.
True. And was released by the same studio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm-mm.
Disney does own both properties now. We could have a crossover.
True facts.
So and Freddie Prinze Jr. is in Star Wars Rebels, the animated series, so Sarah Michelle Gellar could easily pop up too. Are they still together?
Yeah,
I think so.
Who's with who?
Freddie Prinze Jr.
And the star of this.
Okay.
They're married. They've been married for quite a while.
I remember that from earlier that she started. My memory isn't that bad. Just, I'm not going to care who she is after this day.
Sure, Grandma. Let's get you to bed.
Why did we watch this? The podcast with three friends, sometimes four friends, watch a deeply troubled movie, talk about what they like, what they didn't like, and how they would fix it, all while enjoying a themed cocktail.
Oh,
I'm your host for this episode, Brendan. Take my crabs, Amanda Trishler.
I'm Chris. Nobody's that perfect, Chris. Ravel.
And I am Lee. Sharing your cyberspace, that's a big step, Tom. Delahanty.
And we have a special guest with us tonight. Who's this special guest to my left?
I'm Faith. One good sexual thought takes at least 20 minutes. Johnson.
And that voice work, of course, is reference to a bit where we said that Christopher Durang kind of looks like Truman Capote.
He's sort of in almost like Truman Capote drag.
Right, he's in a very sort of southern gentleman linen suit.
An off-mic bit.
Yes, an off-mic bit that we're dragging back up here. The movie we'll be doing this episode is 1999, Simply Irresistible, a romantic comedy directed by Mark Tarlov, written by Judith Roberts, starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, Sean Patrick Flannery, Patricia Clarkson, Dylan Baker, Christopher Durang, Larry Gilliard Jr., and Beatrice Buckley. That's right. It's a star-studded cast of guys.
I mean, you're leaving out one of the most important cast members.
And, of course, a crab.
Yes.
And a spunky little crab that only Sarah Michelle Gellar can see this weekend on Fox.
Other people see it.
No, I know. They do. So this is Simply Irresistible. Now, before we get too into the weeds of what Simply Irresistible is all about, we need to talk, of course, about the drink that we made for Simply Irresistible. The drink that we made is called a Vanilla Fog. It is 2 ounces of smoked bourbon, 1 ounce of apple cider, 1 ounce of chai tea syrup, bitters, and some sparkling water. For the chai syrup, you just take a couple of chai tea bags, 3 ounces of maple syrup, a teaspoon of vanilla extract, and a cup of water. Basically, just heat it till it comes to a simmer. Let it sit so it reduces for a while. Then let it cool, pour it into a bottle, and you can keep it for about a week. For the drink itself, pour the bourbon into a bottle with a stopper. Insert the tube of the smoker into the bottle and fill it with smoke. Put the stopper in the bottle and let it sit for several minutes until thoroughly infused. Add the bourbon, the apple cider, the chai tea syrup, and the bitters to a cocktail shaker with ice. Shake until chilled. Pour into a glass over ice and top with sparkling water. For Faith, we made a similar drink, except we subbed the bourbon for a more earthy herbal tea. For the Vanilla Fog.
Which is the working title of the movie.
Right, this is a reference to the working title of the movie, which was called Vanilla Fog. So, what did you guys think of the Vanilla Fog? I didn't love it.
I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also... Couple things. I was not in a very drinky mood.
Uh-huh.
Just feeling a little drowsy today. I think
yeah.
It's a warm day.
It is a warm day. One of the warmer days we've had.
Allergies are kicking in.
Yep. As you can tell by my voice.
It has a very fall...
Mm-hmm.
That is, I think, the problem.
It's more autumnal. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
The problem is I was trying to go for something that was sort of vanilla-y because of all the vanilla and apple-y from the apple, I guess, dessert at the
okay.
end of the movie.
I went back and forth.
Sometimes
it looks like a peach because
right.
there was a
more
point...
more structural integrity.
Well,
right.
I think they had multiple
I've never
crops.
Seen a fucking peach that looks like it on the outside.
Right. That's what throws me is that from the outside
inside
to me...
Like a peach.
Right. It looks like an
yeah,
apple that they hollowed out... a cavity the size of a peach pit.
It's a quite glossy exterior.
Yeah, it's very difficult to tell what the fuck it is. It could well be a peach.
Well, because it's very difficult to tell what the fuck this movie is.
That's
there's
true.
There's one shot of someone cutting into the apple and it, or the fruit, and it makes a more kind of like crisp apple-y sound. And then, but then the next shot of someone else eating the same dessert, they like open it and split it, and it's clearly a peach. Like it has an orangey inside, and
they might have just had two desserts.
Yeah,
it's a flaw.
But it's red. It's like
it,
red.
It does. I think it looks red. Yeah.
Peach not red.
Peach not red. Peach.
Peach
is peach.
Peach exteriors can be pretty red. I'm with Chris on this one.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyways, so that was, I think, the trouble, is I was trying to sort of mimic the flavor profile a little bit of that. So, unfortunately, those are the flavor profiles of a more autumnal beverage, which obviously not really suited for a day in May like today where
it's
like 70 degrees.
It's not a bad drink.
No, it's not a bad
drink. Flavors come together nicely.
Yes.
It did feel a little weird to drink it now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, maybe if I had been sadder or hornier when I made the drink.
Well, if you let a couple tears.
Yeah, if I cried into it.
Yeah,
well,
I don't think you put your feelings into
it
when you
made
the drink.
You should have like brought your magical crab from home.
I know.
And we drove all the way over here.
I know, we could have brought him with us.
Yeah, and that might have helped.
Yeah, but you know, Faith, like, all the wires they have attached to him to make him move really just don't work so well with the car.
I guess
it's a little hard to get him in there. The whole wire team has to go with us. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. I mean, they could have ridden on the roof.
That's true.
I was threatening to make you do that.
But... yes, that's right. Just like Mitt Romney's dog. Anyways, that is the Vanilla Fog cocktail. Is what it is. C'est la vie.
It turned out better than the snack that I was expecting to bring.
Right, which we did allude to in the previous episode. There was going to be a snack that didn't quite work out as hoped.
My crab Neapolitans were unfortunately rot with soggy bottoms and stuck to the parchment paper therefore did not get brought. But, I mean, I was able to salvage one enough to make it look cute, but, you know, this is an audio medium, so that really wouldn't have... translated.
It did look cute though. Let it be said, it looked like a crab. It sounded like a very good idea nonetheless. So, might not have worked, but you know what? Keep moving forward. Meet the Robinsons. Here we go. Anyways, having covered the drink and the snack that was not meant to be, Lee, would you be so good as to tell us what Simply Irresistible is about?
Yeah, let's go for it. Amanda Shelton inherits her late mother's restaurant, but lacks the ability to cook. The restaurant is failing when Amanda meets a mysterious and possibly magical man at the local market. He introduces himself as Gene O'Reilly and claims to be an old friend of her mother's. He sells her crabs, one of which escapes cooking to become her personal mascot.
Yes.
That's what it says.
Okay.
While chasing the crab, Amanda meets Tom Bartlett, a department store manager at Henry Bendel on Fifth Avenue, who is opening an ambitious new restaurant inside his store. Though they are clearly attached to each other, Tom is involved with a clingy but beautiful woman named Chris. Hello, Chris.
Hey.
Boy, they got you. They have your numbers.
They nailed
out there.
Me.
Clingy and beautiful. That's you, baby.
He's so beautiful.
Tom also talks about how he is an avid paper plane enthusiast and has a display of them inside his office. Later that day, Tom and Chris are on their way to lunch, where Tom plans to break up with Chris, but the cab driver, shown to be Gene, drops them at the wrong location, Amanda's restaurant, the Southern Cross. Tom sees Amanda outside and decides they should have lunch there instead. For unclear reasons, Amanda begins putting her feelings into her food.
For unclear
reasons. That's what it says.
I feel like you could probably put that before every sentence.
Yeah. For unclear reasons, then this happens. And she miraculously becomes an impressive, creative chef. Chris, driven by Amanda's negative feelings toward her cooked into her own food, breaks up with Tom and begins smashing plates in the restaurant. Tom, however, is unbothered as he is more focused on how delicious his crab dish is, with Amanda aspiring to make a truly amazing dish. Amanda visits Tom at Henry Bendel so that he can replace the plates that Chris broke. When he eats eclairs that Amanda baked her passion for Tom into and he feeds her one, they end up in a trance together. He shows her the space where the new restaurant will be, and they have a shared fantasy wherein they dance flirtatiously and they begin a romance. Meanwhile, after Tom's assistant Lois steals an eclair from Tom that Tom himself had stolen from one of Amanda's patrons and is enamored by how delicious it is, she buys as many eclairs from Amanda's restaurant as she can, so she can seduce Jonathan Bendel, the owner of Henry Bendel. As a result of her food improving overnight, the Southern Cross becomes increasingly successful. One night, Tom visits Amanda after the restaurant has closed, and after tasting a dish of hers, they begin to kiss and start floating. Tom panics and breaks things off with Amanda, believing she is some kind of witch who is manipulating his feelings with magic. When Amanda goes to confront Tom one last time at his office, she witnesses the violent tantrum and resignation of a celebrity French chef hired for Tom's new restaurant. When Jonathan realizes that Amanda cooked the eclairs Lois had fed him, he demands that Tom hire her for the opening, despite his protests. On opening night, Amanda is initially shunned by the snobbish French staff, and that, coupled with her continued heartbreak over Tom, causes her to unknowingly cook her sorrow into one of the first courses, causing the entire restaurant to sob uncontrollably. She eventually overcomes her self-doubt and reaches her full potential as a chef, and the opening is a complete success. Stunned but enchanted by the remarkable effect Amanda's food has had on the guests, Tom goes after Amanda as she's leaving the opening. Though initially missing her in the elevator, Tom, upon returning to his office, sees Amanda leaving in a cab. To get her attention, he throws one of his paper airplanes from a balcony into the cab. She hurries back, changes into a special dress he has picked out for her, and admits his love for her. In another moment of shared fantasy, the two reconcile on the dance floor and begin to levitate around the rest of the passionate couples, not noticing Jean is gleefully conducting
gleefully
behind them while the crab wears a top hat, implying the magic that sparked in Amanda came from them, which is not at all what the...
No, no.
Exactly the opposite of what the
of movie, what we believe, yeah, the attention apparently is.
Apparently supposed to do, yeah.
Would not say this movie is great.
Eloquently
consistency.
Told.
Yeah.
Yes. Lee, do you want to real quick give us, like, just a couple characters and actors?
Yeah,
like,
so you got Sarah Michelle Gellar as Amanda, Sean Patrick Flannery as Tom Bartlett, Patricia Clarkson is Lois, Dylan Baker is Jonathan, Christopher Durang is Jean. I don't know who played the crab.
Oh, I'll look it up.
Damn it. Who made that little...
Oh, apparently he also played Sebastian in the live-action Little Mermaid that was done recently by Rob Marshall.
Oh, you can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you should see his
Amanda
tweets.
Amanda Pete was...
They are not great.
Is he milkshake that?
Yeah, well, he said some really bad things about casting a black Ariel after the fact, so that's why he's not the premiere if you look at that.
Oh, who the fuck was Nolan Trainer?
That's the super
I was the
black guy.
Oh, the black
the,
guy.
The, like, lone character of color.
Yeah, the lone character of color. Larry, that was Larry Gillard. We looked up and he was in...
Things.
Other things that we've seen, yeah.
Like, yeah. He has had a career,
yes.
In spite of the fact that he is not good in this. But then
and then who was Charlie?
Who plays Charlie?
Gabriel Macht.
What?
I don't know, he's credited as Charlie.
Oh, is that just one of the department store workers?
Yeah, I wonder if that's...
Or maybe a guy, I think he's the guy at the beginning at the farmer's market who's kind of flirting with her, because Gabriel Macht is a name I've heard.
Yeah.
I think he's like a Z-list actor.
They tried to...
Z-list.
They gave him his own Frank Miller, like, movie, The Spirit.
Oh, that's right,
oh.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to be his big push into...
He's the main character in Suits. I don't know if he's Z-list.
Oh, yes. He's a very blandly handsome person.
Okay, so maybe that's why I thought he was Z-list, because he is just one of those bland people. But yeah, oh, I think he is, like, the guy at the beginning.
Catching Stray is this guy.
One of the farmer's markets.
Successful USA
Gabriel
Network
Max.
Show.
Instead
the
of
Gabriel
suits.
Mach, like, army is going to come after
yeah.
him now.
Yeah.
Instead of Suits, they should have called it Mach Trial.
Oh, that would be so good. I'm really glad characters were welcome.
Not anymore, Chris. Regime change.
Oh.
So that's Simply Irresistible. Now let's discuss... Was it Simply Irresistible?
I found it irresistible to laugh at.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
know.
A baffling movie.
Yeah, yes, it is
yeah.
a movie that I would describe. It's a similar feeling to, like, let's say you were in your pantry and a large jar of pickles fell on your head and gave you a concussion. This might be what you would see, I think. This would be
yeah.
something
yeah.
like your life would appear to you as you were stumbling around that kitchen with a concussion.
It vaguely resembles a narrative, but really makes no sense.
I've talked about the movie Dazzle, have I? With the fairy that becomes, that has to...
You have mentioned
yeah.
this.
I own it on DVD. I don't know if there's any other way to watch it. I think we should absolutely do it for the podcast. And I would describe... I would put Dazzle in, like, the same category
as
this. Where it's like you're watching it and you're like... It's so bad, and you can't look away. You're
yeah,
like,
that was my experience watching this a few months ago, and that's why I was just like, Brendan, I think you need to watch.
Right, so yeah,
it's like movie shaped. It's movie flavored. Yes,
it does have the vague, flabby outline of a movie.
It's like
Hershey's chocolate.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
But it's
not a real movie, but an incredible simulation of one.
Yeah, kind of. I mean. There are many points in this movie where it just felt like it was made by aliens. Because it just felt like this was made by someone who hadn't watched a movie, but had only seen, like, pieces of a movie or, like, trailers or something.
But also, I'm not sure that the people who made this have ever had conversations with human beings.
I feel like that's kind of the thing. I feel like they've never spoken to anyone. So this is
But they got the broadcast, so they know what conversations look like.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
But they don't really know how
discusses.
What
they don't know what the words are.
Right. Like, you know, people talk, but you don't know what they're actually saying to each other.
I know it was 99, so it couldn't have been AI. But I feel like if you showed like a Gen Z kid this now and be like, yeah, this was made by AI, they would
like this would be like the early versions of AI, like where it was still kind of learning how to put pieces together, but it never really quite worked. I think that could be the case.
So this is directed by one Mark Tarlov, RIP apparently, who died a few years ago, and written by his wife, Judith Roberts. So this is a husband and wife team working together on this movie. Now, Mark Tarlov is a producer, most notably, produced a fair amount of movies like Christine, Serial Mom, Cecil B. Demented, Pecker, The Man Who Knew Too Little.
All of the work with
John Waters
just makes it feel, I don't know, that's at least like interesting and kind of wild. And there was like, obviously those movies are chaotic, but you can actually follow them and understand the story unlike this.
Yeah, I mean, like there's thought behind them and this does not have any thought behind it.
Well, here's the thing, right? I feel like if I were to have watched this movie, I could have probably walked away with one or two or three themes in my head as to what I thought this movie might have been about. Now, having done that, I decided to poke around online to see, like, is there any sort of canonical explanation as to where they were coming from? And boy, is there! There is a Huffington Post interview with the husband and wife team about this. I'm not going to read all this verbatim. There's a few choice selections I'm going to throw out here. The question for the writer, the plot of this film is unusual. What was your initial vision for the film? I get a lot of ideas. Some of them have stickiness, some of them don't. This one was really about how women feel with power. I wanted to express what I felt was a challenge for women. How do you manage your power? So
it's just simply not the movie.
It's important to know that was apparently the writer's theme going into this. Mark, the director, I read an interview in which he said this was really a movie about physics. Can you explain that a little? I have certain obsessions, one of which is particle physics. Einstein's theory of relativity says the laws of physics are the same for everyone who shares a frame of reference. Food sets a frame of reference, so there is a shared sense of the laws of physics, which exists nowhere else except over a plate of food. The example I use is reading a book on an airplane. It's not a problem because you and the book are moving at the same speed, so you're both sitting still. But if you're not on the plane, the book is flying at 600 miles per hour, and you're not going to be able to read it at all. The question is, how do you embrace the people you're with in the same frame of reference? It's all about Einstein and theory. Now, I'm sure that's the answer to a question.
My God.
This guy, are you sure he's not a coke addict?
This is honestly... This feels so close to like reading Richard Kelly talk about Southland Tales,
yes.
Where I'm like, oh boy, there is so much
this
going
feels
on here.
Like reading the fucking like Epstein emails.
Right.
So, okay, here's the thing that just blows my mind about this. What the fuck does physics have to do with anything that we watched there? And then what is even the connection between physics and a shared frame of reference?
I got one follow for you on the physics here. The interviewer is asking the question about how they thought that Tom's character was kind of an asshole.
Yes.
And they said, do you agree? And the writer said, no, I think he's terrified. The director said, he's one of those guys. There's a million of them. He's an immovable object fighting an irresistible force. And it's just, I feel like if you were the interviewer at that point, you're like, oh boy, again with the physics, are we? So you've got that. Roberts, the writer, says he even believed his ability with the paper planes was fully scientific. He thought that he, as a master of the universe, could determine the trajectory of a paper airplane so precisely. So it's important to remember that also the airplane is apparently magic in some way. The way he threw the airplane is representational of a force of magic, okay, and not just because...
So is he imbibing the airplanes with his feelings the way she is doing right. with her cooking?
But the thing also to remember is this is about women, mostly. So it's like, so men don't have magic, or they do have magic, and this magic only applies to paper airplanes.
It's not a... I mean, they can both have magic, but it's about how women manage their magic.
Do we know the gender of the crab?
Important.
That's a good question.
You have to flip it upside down to check. I don't think they ever do that. So
what if, though, you were reading a book on that paper airplane?
You'd be fine, Chris, because you'd be moving with the book as fast as the paper airplane was moving.
What if I was off the plane?
Chris, now that's where the problem starts.
I love that he's saying the book will be moving too fast to read it, and it's like, it might also have to do with me not being in the same space.
That being, like, in the
same space.
I'm not on the plane.
I am just obsessed with how he thinks...
Any of this is... sense.
Even with the... Let's go very briefly with the premise that there is a clear... and present connection between the concept of physics and this. The explanation he chooses to use doesn't even demonstrate physics. It's not a physics problem that you're talking about reading on the plane. Like, what?
I mean, I just don't understand what physics has to do with any of this. That is my question here. And I know he says the thing about an unstoppable force.
Well, and there's a specific kind of physics that happened right over the plate that happened nowhere else.
Right, exactly.
Well, I mean, that crab Napoleon dish did just sort of appear. I mean, we are led to believe that she is making it, but maybe that dish was being made on an airplane.
Right, so if that dish was on an airplane at 600 miles an hour, if she wasn't there, then the dish could have appeared in front of her because it was moving so fast she wouldn't have realized it was there. But really, it came from a flight attendant.
Yeah.
And actually, when you actually think about it, this movie is entirely about physics, because how did they float to the top if it wasn't
That's true.
Physics?
You know what? I withdraw every concern. I think we've worked it out. Have a good night, everyone.
The disappearing fop is the flight attendant.
Yes, right.
The disappearing fop.
So, yeah.
Okay, it does really feel like, though, that this movie was made by two complete crazy people.
I mean, I think it's nice
Sorry.
That crazy people
I've
together.
Been reading the same interview on the page. And
well, I also have to say, by the way, you had the world's most amazing facial expression as all of that was being read.
I think that my specialty is that I have the ability to sort of parse madness.
So what are they saying, Lee? Tell us.
Well, I think that essentially this Tarlov guy has no idea what the fuck he's talking about.
Agreed.
I think he's just talking out of his ass, essentially.
Yeah.
And that he brings up physics, which made him think of the idea of connecting over a shared love or a shared idea, which could be music, in this
case
it's food.
Sure.
So it's connecting through... He's just talking about connecting through food.
But physics doesn't play in...
I think he's talking about, like, forces, though.
I think he's dramatically misunderstanding Einstein's theory of relativity. If I understand it correctly, which maybe I don't, and I think he heard someone talk about the theory of relativity, and he connected on this idea of the laws of physics being the same for everyone who shares a frame of reference, and then he took that to mean food is a shared frame of reference, so there's a shared sense of the laws of physics. I think he's just talking about you can understand someone through food or communicate.
Yeah.
So he's almost just using the invocation of physics, like anything. He could have just used literally any other word. He was just driving towards this idea.
I mean, it does feel like this is a guy who looked up the word physics on Wikipedia one day, and then his wife was like, hey, I looked up cooking on Wikipedia. Can I tell you a little bit about that? And he's like, actually, that sounds a lot like physics, and proceeded to bend over backwards to make it relate to
that. Maybe they were both looking at the simple English versions, and there was nuance lost.
One of the ideas that I think I could see him keying into with, like, Einstein theories and, like, particle physics is the idea of... particles being the particles are apart but connected at the same time, which is a big part of people thinking about, like, oh, does that mean that we could have, like, wormholes and shit, or, like, what's it called? There's a word for it.
Quantum entanglement.
Thank you, Chris.
Is what I'm thinking.
I'm a science person.
I think that that's also a very, like, that's I could see that being an idea that he read about and as a writer just took to be like, ooh.
Right, just was like inspired by the loosest concept of that.
Yeah, it connects to vaguely to the idea of, like, people being connected at a distance or, like, soulmates or things like that or like, magic. So I think that he's just gone in a wiki hole about physics.
But they both also seem both so woo-woo, I would believe it if they had just, like, turn to their cult leader or, like, their crystals expert, and this is what he said. No, it's about physics, but not the way you would think of it. It's about vibrations and energy.
I mean, it reminds me of, like, Jane Lynch in A Mighty Wind, where they're talking about how their religion is color. And, like, they can see color. But, like, the thing that, like, I did not really screen cap too much of here, so I don't have, like, the exact quotes, is at various points, the woman who wrote it, his wife, is talking about what the deal is with the magic. And she keeps talking about the concept of witchcraft. And now, I'm going to be honest, when I first saw this movie and Tom was, I think she's a witch, she made me levitate, she's a witch, she's gonna fly in here on a broom, witch, I was like, okay, this guy's just misreading the situation. There was no intention that this character is supposed to be a witch. It's magic realism. You look at this, I'm like, no, we really think she might have some family history of witch. Her mom, we think, had this sort of thing too. And so there's that also. You're not only
baking wait, so a, that's an element of backstory that was just in their heads.
According
not
to
the
her,
movie.
It was removed as they kept refining the screenplay. That this was something that her mother was able to
refining
do.
Refining is doing a lot of heavy.
Yeah, that's true. As they continue to write more.
I think it was Brendan, I can't remember who said this, one of the three of you did, about just, it's funny to see these people who just had all of these ideas in their head while they were writing it that do not really come up in the movie, and then they're like, what do you mean you didn't get that? It was right there.
Yeah, no, it is the thing that he says particularly about the crab, where he says something like, the difference between me and Spielberg is Spielberg would never make a crab. Maybe I fucked up by making it a crab.
I love that they make it like a highlight.
Right, yes. Yeah, somebody like Spielberg would not pick a crab. That's why he's Spielberg and I'm me. It was probably a mistake.
Yeah. And the article, like, really blows that quote.
To be like, yeah, like, guys.
This is who I had to talk to.
Yes. You really do have to love. This is probably just some person who, like, saw this movie on TV when they were, like, 12 and was like, that was a fun, weird little movie. Like, let's talk to the writer and director and see what fun insight they have to say. And,
like,
and all
no,
of a sudden, it's... they're just talking about, like, is the crab magic? Are the earrings magic? Is she a witch? What's physics doing?
And they're like, no, it's really deep, actually.
Right, yeah.
And they're being indoctrinated into a cult right now.
Yes, exactly. So there's a lot of thoughts happening here in this movie. Unlike Sarah Michelle Gellar, the thoughts that they're thinking don't really show in the final product.
I mean, I had said at various points that the movie kind of at times felt like it was like a TV film or something, but another thing that came to me when we were watching it is that it almost felt like it was a play before this.
This very much to me has the feel of an off-Broadway play that was turned into a movie, because it's very short on sets, you know? You could basically do this with two sets. You could do this with, like, the department store
and
the
diner,
and that's pretty much it. Anything else could kind of be worked around. This has the feel of, like, almost, what was that? Requiem for an Insomniac? That one movie that, what, the one that you liked?
Requiem for an Insomnia.
What the fuck was
dream
that? Dream for an
insomnia.
Yeah, whatever it is. Requiem for a Dream. Yeah.
Requiem for a Dream for an Insomnia.
Yes.
Requiem for a Dream for an Insomnia.
Yeah, boy, that was a weird ass movie. But it has, like, the feel
don't
of that,
right?
Don't
say I liked it, okay? I was very young.
A movie that made an impression on you in some way.
When I was very young and I thought, that's what I want to be like when I grow up.
Insomnia.
But, yeah, it has that same sort of feel where it's like, this is basically one set, and in adapting it to a movie, they cheated and were like, okay, we'll show you the bedroom, we'll show you his office, we'll show you a little more of the restaurant, all that sort of shit.
We'll give you, like, one seat out on the street.
Right, and I mean, even the inclusion of something like Christopher Durang, who I think is more well-known as a playwright than he is as an actor, despite the fact that he has acted some, makes it feel sort of, if you were to tell me that Christopher Durang wrote the play that this is based
on, I would believe you.
And he just pops in as a cameo, yeah, I would be like, oh, okay, that makes some level of sense.
I'm pretty sure Christopher Durang was supposed to write better things than this.
I believe so, yes. I would go so far as to say that Christopher Durang would probably write a better script or play than this movie.
Give us the Durang cut.
So do we know if he has, like, any connection to these people? Like,
I don't believe, not so far as I can tell.
He's
I think
in the same cult as the, the writer and director.
I think it was just that he, again, he was kind of trying to be an actor, I believe. And I feel like it was something, you know, like that, like with Julian Fellowes too, where he was, like, trying to be an actor for a long time and it was never really taking off. And then he's like, fuck it, I'll write something instead. And then it was like, oh, you're good at this. Like, keep doing this. Don't act.
I actually don't think I knew he used
to
be an actor.
He used to be an actor. Yeah. People, I mean, look, Tarantino still thinks he could be an actor for some reason. He still thinks that Paul Dano can't. Who knows? Anyways.
I had no idea that's
another
what Julian
all-time
quote.
Like.
I know, right? Well, that's why he could be an actor also. What were you saying?
Yes,
like,
of course.
Can I get another quote in?
Yeah, please. Too? Drop it.
When the person's asking, like, will her powers go on after the crab dies?
Yes.
And Tarlov says, yes, her power's not in the crab, it's in her. We want, as humans, to attribute everything to something. But in fact, it's the collective unconscious that makes us who we are and who we are and who loves us. I think that's got to be part typo as well. It's such an insane sentence.
I would hope so, but also...
It feels like there's a clause that got drawn.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's the collective conscious that makes us who we are and who we aren't. I feel like it's supposed to be that makes us who we are and who we are who loves us. I don't know.
So the other thing I would comment on the magic real quick, and I was debating about throwing this in later, but like, hell, why not? Now we're going through this interview here. You had briefly sort of covered this with your own quote there, Lee, but they're basically the interviewer had asked them, why the crab? And Tarlov says, we wanted something that communicated that it doesn't matter whether this is real or not. The thing about it is, and I think it's part of the film's failure with audiences initially, was there is no explanation for so much of this stuff. You might as well just embrace it. The thing about the crab is, it is ridiculous. It's so ridiculous it can only mean it doesn't matter. Everything doesn't need an explanation. There are some things you need to take on faith. I wanted to find some embodiment of that in the familiar. In this case, it had to be a food thing. In the end, she thinks it's her mom's earrings, but then she does it without her earrings, so she understands her abilities are internal.
Even giving his... that single answer, we wandered all over the place.
Now, what I would also say, if the thought you were trying to express here is that it doesn't matter, why have a crab at all? Why not just have no crab?
Well,
why not have nothing that explains why they're floating or why she's making a vanilla fog?
He also
why
she's... I kind of don't mind the earrings as a concept.
I don't either.
Because, like, it is supposed to be like, oh, this is like the spirit of my mother.
Right.
So maybe it's like, I put on this piece of her and therefore that's what...
No, I don't either. But it seems that his intention is like, none of that's real. The earrings are the magic feather in Dumbo. They don't matter, right?
Yeah.
It's like, she thinks they matter, so she does better work because she thinks they do.
His answer is making me feel two different things. One, I think there was an intention, which I don't mind. I actually like the idea of, which is what comes with magical realism, of like, you're not supposed to question it, you're just supposed to kind of go along with it.
Right.
Where I think the movie fucks that up, though, is in having so much acknowledgement of how weird it is and drawing so much attention to how impossible it is, which is then prompting the viewer to be like, okay, well, if that's an issue inside of the world of the movie, this is something I should be thinking about.
Right.
Which I think gets in its way. Right? So, like, you don't need that guy to complain about hitting the ceiling, because if you want to do the magical realism, you shouldn't just have anyone question it, period.
Right.
And well, then it also feels like they were trying to do, like, a gotcha, sort of like, oh, you thought it was this magical crab or these magical earrings, but it's actually her inner power. But the movie never, ever, conveys that.
You're right. Lee, did you want to throw something else?
Sorry. When you make that, like, her inner power.
I didn't realize that when you're talking about the dolls being a thing, that the interviewer directly asked about the dolls.
Yep.
And the interviewer's question is, at one point, the character Nolan goes into Amanda's bedroom, picks up her dolls, and starts smashing them together, making them kiss and simulate sex. Why would a grown man do such a thing? So that's why they answer that, like, the actor just started doing that.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, that's great. But I love that the interviewer is like hey.
But why would an adult do this?
What the fuck was up with that?
Right. And I mean, the thing I want to stress also, it's not like these are two Barbie dolls, which are like, you know, say like young adult dolls. These are like baby dolls.
Yeah.
That he is smashing. At first it seems like he's making them fight, and then it looks like he's making them kiss. I don't know what he's doing, but either way, like, a weird sentiment to sort of toss off into your movie there. I digress.
What if we kissed in front of the magic crab?
In front of Sarah Michelle Gellar's baby doll bed? Yeah. So that's the interview that's giving us a lot of backbone for some of this discussion, which I think in a way is sort of a godsend, because so many of the movies that we do have no real explanation for why these choices were made. And I'm grateful that someone was able to pump these two nutcases for information about why this movie is the way it is.
At least an attempt was made.
Yes.
It also completely tracks that these are the people that made this movie, because their answers in the interview are as incoherent as this movie.
Yes. So
one more incoherent.
Go. Give it.
I wanted to ask about the iconic statistic, the average man thinks about sex 138 times a day.
This is a good one.
Is this real? This is the one where the study doesn't exist. They were like, I read it in an article. And then Tarlov says, this is the most insane answer I've ever seen. I don't think this makes any sense.
Uh-huh.
It comes back to this whole idea that men are really binary, all zeros and ones. Women, at least in my estimation, are not. It's an on-off thing. You're either thinking about it or you're not. There's no room for nuance. That was a very fundamental notion of mine about men and women. Men are digital, women are polynomial.
What?
The thing I also want to throw out here is not binary on off also?
Yes! Yes!
Is that not what binary is?
Yes!
Yes.
Okay. Great. So this
in
guy
fact,
is just
when he said zeros and ones. That's and literally binary
right,
code.
Right.
Digital and polynomial are not opposites.
Right. They're not at odds with each other.
Not at all.
They're two different things.
Also,
right. Digital and analog.
Yes.
Could be.
Sure, but he might just mean digital in terms of like numbers. But even if that was the case, polynomials are still digital because they're
they
made
can
of
be
digits.
Digital or yeah.
Right. And I mean, it seems like this is sort of boiling down to a very basic 90s, like, boy, men are from Mars and women
but
are from Venus, am I right?
But
like,
it's just so fascinating that they keep wanting to reference these grand ideas as if they're very enlightening or if, I mean, let alone not make any sense. But it just makes me wonder, like, are these just two, like, rich, batty people who,
they're
inside
dumb.
Their own little echo chamber, just,
yeah.
like, spout bullshit at each other, and they're like, that's fucking brilliant, put that in a movie.
I mean, yeah, these guys
like,
are
they
dumb
speak
as fuck.
Yeah.
They speak with buzzwords,
yeah.
like, exclusively.
I mean, again, as
yeah.
we said, like, when watching this is just a movie where, like, no one said no to any decision that anyone wanted to make. You've got the guy making the two dolls make out or fight each other. You've got Betty Buckley's weird-ass Rube Goldberg martini machine that she uses, like, twice in the movie.
And just tries to randomly offer martinis.
Right, it's
that
like she right. She makes a martini and then like offers it to Amanda Peet in Haircut, and she's does anyone want a martini? And both like no thanks. And she's like okay, and starts sipping it, and walks away. So like again, to me, my read on that scene is like this is a drunk, and she just wants an excuse to have a martini.
Well, but it's also like there was no real. And I mean, I think the martini machine was meant to be another like whimsical,
sure, of course,
magical realism thing, and I guess it is whimsical, but again. And like it's they haven't done the work to sell the magical realism, so those moments don't really play. In fact, I would argue the only time where the magical realism with the food thing works even a little is the final dinner sequence.
Yeah.
Where it's like crying and then they're horny and then they're in this quiet trance and then
they're all romantic.
And then they're romantic again and yeah, like
I mean, I think it's the only scene where the kind of concept is really clear that her emotions are getting cooked into the food.
Yes.
I guess because
right.
she cries into
so,
that Pepto-Bismol borscht.
Right. So
and like
the weird thing is in the beginning we kind of they sort of pay lip service to this as a concept. Where in
yeah.
the first scene where she's cooking for Amanda Peet and Haircut at the restaurant, she serves Amanda Peet like a chicken dish
chicken
in a yard. Right, yes. And she serves Haircut the crab Napoleon dish that she made up. And he's just like, so good. Oh my god, this is succulent, it's delicious, blah blah blah. And Amanda Peet's like, actually, you know what, boyfriend? Like, you suck. You suck, and I don't like you, and you're a jerk, and no one likes you.
And
she starts...
I'm going to rub my mashed potatoes on your face
right.
because I'm perfect, and
right,
I'm
like,
going to throw out all these mismatched plates because...
Amanda Peet plays it as if she's surprised by everything she's saying.
I mean, she plays it, it's like someone slipped her a truth serum, and all of a
yes.
sudden she's coming up with all these things that she would never dare to say.
But like,
about how much she hates
him. Right? Like,
yeah.
the inhibitors, like, it's like she has no, because she just gets up
right.
from throwing plates.
Right, there's, yeah, there's like no filter on her at all anymore, so
yeah.
she just like is reduced to a basic id
yeah.
at
it
that
also,
point.
It also is, though, it is very unclear, really, okay, so... A, I guess you could, any of us could argue what the emotion was that got cooked into that chicken fire that made her do that. I'm guessing anger. But it's not just that. It was specific things that Sarah Michelle Gellar said about her.
Right.
Yeah, it's
like, that are
it's,
then then she repeats, but
right,
as, like, reasons why I'm too good for you. So
yeah.
then I'm like, so... But she's not, I do not get her playing angry.
She's not playing angry. Like, it would be one thing if she was like, I am so much fucking better than you.
Right.
I've got great hair and skin. What am I doing with you? And threw plates at him because
she
was mad.
If she screamed that whole thing, that would have made a lot more sense.
Right. So in that, I don't really get that she is infusing any of her emotions into the food. It seems like the
just
food...
Just her thoughts? Or criticism?
I guess, yeah.
I mean, that's the only time it's really thoughts, though. Like, it does become feelings, but
right.
then also
well, so,
it makes people fly.
Right, because the thing...
Nothing is consistent.
The thing I would say is that it seems like for much of the movie's runtime, the only thing out of the ordinary is that Amanda Peet suddenly decides to start dropping truth bombs. Everyone else who eats her food for much of the movie's runtime just becomes like super into the food. And it's just like, oh my god,
and like
so fucking
stoned, kind of.
I don't know. Are they really like the people at the restaurant don't seem to be stoned. They're just like, boy, dinner is great.
That's
like, give
true.
Me more dinner, please. The people eating the eclairs are just like, oh my god,
well,
eclairs.
They're also getting way horny.
Right, that's true too.
When they eat the eclairs.
Right, it's so it just feels like
Which
the other. Emotion is that everyone is like hot for food.
Yes.
That's kind of it. And
yes.
then at
well,
the end
she's hot
for haircut.
For haircut.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess...
Hot for haircut.
She's hot for haircut, baby.
That's the next t-shirt. But probably, for me, my absolute favorite scene was just seeing Patricia Clarkson play horniness after eating the caramel.
Writhing around on a chair.
Yeah. Well, she's like...
Right.
It's so good. Yeah. She's so good.
Yeah.
Very erotic acting.
Wrapped around that chair.
Yes. She's really delivering a full meal of a performance there. Yeah.
But it is, I guess that's why I really liked the final banquet scene, just because we at least got multiple emotions. Whereas, I would argue that it's either people are horny or for people, or they're horny for food.
Right. I feel like if maybe more of that emotional thing was a central conceit going into it, maybe there would be something to it here. I mean, as it is also, this is just kind of, it feels like it's just cribbing from Like Water for Chocolate.
Yeah.
Where the woman cries into the wedding cake and then everyone starts crying after they're eating it. So like, it's kind of just a direct lift on that, frankly.
I don't know. Is there a little bit of chocolat in here?
Yeah, there's a little bit of chocolat, I think, here too.
Even though this came out before
yeah, this does precede chocolat, but
wait,
yes.
Wait, did Simply Irresistible inspire chocolat?
Yeah, the chocolat actually
also,
like ripped off?
Like the floating is, I guess, I mean, we don't know, but it's, for all intents and purposes, it seems like it's really happening.
Yeah.
So, like, that's...
But they hallucinate the dance sequence.
Right, that's what
and
I don't get.
They hallucinate two dance sequences, because the Wikipedia thing implied that they were hallucinating floating over the dance.
Okay, I don't trust that, but we do seem to think that the first dance sequence when she comes to visit him at work and they see the restaurant is imaginary.
That also because it cuts back to them.
Right.
It is a folly à deux situation because they talk about it with each other.
Right,
and
they're both
you
like,
do see Dylan Baker walk in and be like, what the fuck are you
doing? Right, he's like, excuse me.
It seems like lost time because it seems like they had a whole...
Right, they had like a whole like 2-minute dance sequence
and it was
Dylan
like
Baker
seconds.
Just walks in and is like, hey, what's going on? And then they look up and see him. Yeah, no, that one I can't make heads or tails of, frankly, because that one very much does seem to be a dream sequence that Dylan Baker does not partake of.
I guess what I'm getting at is, like, aside from, like, you know, the conceit of the movie being realized only at the end, is, like, what's the point of it? Like, if... what's the point of, like, you eat food and you get the emotions of it?
Well, it's not a story unto itself, right?
I think it approaches having a point, and
yes.
I kind of want to get into that, maybe as part of my fix. Maybe a little bit we can get into it now.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it kind of approaches having a point when they are doing the crying bit, and everyone's sort of like, oh, I should have done this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, okay, so maybe there's like, she could like cook food and make people like...
Inspired.
Like cooking therapy.
Right.
Like,
right. They get in touch with their true selves or something.
Yeah.
And I think there's also, if you could take it in the direction too of like, if you're like really putting your heart and soul in this thing, traumatized that can be like, I literally put my emotion in this and that made people feel things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true. I guess we were kind of already sort of talking about the kind of the story and tone of all this. Is there anything anyone else wanted to say? I mean, this...
I mean, we're like wildly all over the place, but so is everything in this.
Right.
So...
yeah. The interview also alludes to lifting from MGM movie musicals a lot. Like, the woman who wrote it talks a lot about loving those sort of old Hollywood rom-coms and musicals. And there are so many direct lifts of that. Like, the dance sequence, the scene at the end, just the sort of cinematic conceits of people, like, floating or stuff like that. But I feel like the thing that they are missing out on here is that in Royal Wedding, when Fred Astaire dances on the ceiling, the rest of the movie isn't him having an existential crisis because he's wondering how the fuck did I just dance on the ceiling,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like, I feel like that's like the tone problem that I have, is that everyone in the movie, aside from haircut, is just willing to go along with this. And he's the one who's like, she's a witch. I don't know what her deal is. She made me levitate. How did she make me levitate? And everyone else is just sort of like, I don't know, man. Fucking go with it. Who cares?
I would say, like, she's kind of freaked up.
She is a little freaked out with it. That's true. I will give you that. But for the most part, she's just sort of like, I don't know. Like, what do you want from me? Like, what are you mad at me for? We're floating. What of it?
I would say it's not too... There are movies you could look at, I feel like. I don't know which one. There definitely are, and I wish I could cite them.
Yeah.
But, like, well, it kind of makes me think of, like, Bewitched or, like,
sure.
A Dream of Jeannie, where
sure.
a guy is sort of befuddled or exasperated
sure.
by magical antics happening and sort of being a bit mistrusting of it.
Uh-huh.
There's, like, that kind of vibe, which is not MGM musical.
No.
And I don't know that this movie successfully evokes an MGM musical in any way.
No, I would say the most does is, like, sometimes people dance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about that one fantasy dance sequence in the middle being kind of unsettling.
Yeah.
It's shot weird, and it has a lot of, like, weird sharp cuts. And the floor looks like something in a Hitchcock movie.
Right.
Yeah, it's very Vertigo-esque.
Right. Exactly.
It is the Black Lodge from Twin Peaks. Like,
yeah. Apparently, the floor is also a direct lift from some movie musical. I don't know what it is, but
it's
yeah.
It's upsetting.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly just did not have the physical space to work with and also not the cinematic know-how to cheat that.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of it also is you understand these visuals, but you don't understand what they mean. Or how they were used. Like, you want to include this because you liked it in another movie, but you don't understand how the movie used it.
Well, let alone how to make it work for your movie.
Right.
To make it, like, make sense and fit.
And I think the counterpoint I would say also to the Bewitched thing, too, is that in Bewitched, there are normal people who cannot know that Samantha has powers, but they would not, like, hand wave it away. If they, like, if their nosy neighbor, Mrs. Kravitz, is always like, something crazy is going on over here, you know? Like, I think that's the thing. If the neighbors were just like, so what? She made, like, a horse appear. Get over it, Darren, you know? Like, that would be one thing.
That'd be pretty funny.
Right. I just think that the fact that, like, he is the only character in the movie who's like, do you guys not see what is happening here? And everyone else is just like, guy, relax. We're also fucking horny.
Have another horny eclair.
I'm Samantha from Sex and the City. I love fucking.
Just one other thing I just wanted to put out there about the tone before we move on from that. I think it just comes from the very alien nature of this whole movie. Mm-hmm. Just there was at times a dreamlike feeling, but that felt more like The Room than like magical realism. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. No, I mean,
where
I think
it just felt
is...
like so weird and uncanny, and I'm just like, literally like you're watching a simulacrum.
No, I mean, again, I think it's just that like they understand the things that people do, but they don't understand why they do them or what they're actually doing. They understand that people will kiss, people will talk, people will eat, but they don't really sort of get like what's happening in the scene.
And like how you tell a story with these actions.
Correct. And they also understand that people want to eat white goo.
They do, yeah. People want to eat a lot of goo. Hey, pink goo. Green
and
goo.
And when fog comes out of an apple, that's just fun.
Or a peach, we don't know.
Or a peach, we don't know what it is.
Yeah,
maybe it's some heretofore unknown fruit that just releases
a apple.
Fog.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. So having gone into all of that, I guess, is there really a need to talk about like what the magic kind of is?
I think we've kind of covered
it. We've kind of covered it. The thing is, I really like the concept of the magic of like...
In what sense?
In the sense that I like this idea of the emotions you have are going into the food. I like this idea of cooking being this kind of like magical, mystical thing. I like that idea. It's just, I'm just bummed to see it so fucking fumbled.
Sure. And I mean, like, that's like, that's such a strong concept that so many movies have done. I mean, like, it's sort of easy to look at this movie and be like, this is a proto-Ratatouille, but with a crab instead of a rat.
Yeah.
But like that again, that's another movie that sort of strives to deconstruct the idea of like, what is it about food? What is like, what is our connection with food? How do we bond over food? And like, that's not the main crux of the plot by any means, but that is a part of it. And I feel like that could be the case here as well. This could be another movie.
It could be. I don't think it really goes into...
No, I'm not saying it is, but what I'm saying is, like, it feels like the director and the writer are interested in the idea about, like, what is it about food that brings people together and how we respond to it and why it's sort of erotic in a way. Like, they seem to have a weird eroticism associated with food, which, like, I get a little bit because there are certain things, like, you know, like, your mouth is an erogenous zone, right? It's like, strawberries, you know, are a sexy fruit and all that shit. Like, dip them into your lover's mouth, whatever, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, I think much like how these people don't know how to, like, they don't understand how conversations work. I don't think they understand how sex works.
No.
No, I think that's also why it's a very chaste movie.
Hey, girl, Sam.
Yeah.
I think you could do this better than they could, though, Lee, if you really put your mind to it.
You're right,
well, I don't agree that, I mean, I agree that maybe this movie is. I don't think it inherently has to be erotic, the whole food.
No, I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying it's not.
I will say that there's definitely a cozy video game either already out or being developed as we speak, that is about a witch who like cooks like magical meals, and you grow your own little herbs, and you put your individual like
I'm sure there's a romanticy already being written.
Soul there probably are books about this.
Sure,
like,
I'm sure there are.
There's actually, I believe, a now very popular anime, but was a popular manga called Witch Hat Atelier, which is just that. It's teaching which is how to cook food.
I don't think that's what it's about.
Sorry, there is a spinoff from that that was about cooking food.
Right, so I mean, I think that's certainly true. Like, and again, I don't think that's a bad, like, that's not like an insane swing of a concept, you know? Like, if this were indeed a movie about a woman who discovers her family's witch lineage and starts, like, using magic to bake food, and then the magic that she is imbibing the food with has some sort of side effects where it's causing,
by the way.
Yeah, you're right, imbibe is drink. Where it's causing, like, side effects where some people, you know, like, are responding to her emotions, where she's trying to make people fall in love eating some food that she's making. Like, I think that's perfectly fine. Like, that'd be a perfectly fine movie to watch. I think the problem is that this movie, like, doesn't really, again, this movie swings with the concept of witchcraft, where haircut is like, she's a witch. But I walked away from this movie being like, well, no, she's not a witch. Like, this is magic realism, and he's just kind of like having a breakdown. Right. And then you read this interview, and they're like, actually, she might have been a witch.
But so
it's like, not magic, it's a force.
Right. Right. And so it's like, they're clearly needed some sort of like mystic feminine sort of energy or something coming from her that's like also associated with witches and stuff like that. So, like, again, perfectly valid thing to make a movie about. I'm not saying like any of this is bad. I'm saying that, like,
it's done badly.
Right. I'm saying you either need to make it a text or you need to make the subtext stronger. Either way is fine. It's just not doing it.
Mm-hmm. I have one very nitpicky, this isn't really a plot hole, but just sort of a nitpicky question about the plot. So what happens after that first night? Is she now the head chef for Jonathan's at...
I mean, right? Does her restaurant close?
The French guy quit. I mean, she could run two restaurants, like...
She could, but, like, that feels like it's...
But only one of them is going to get the great magic food.
I mean, they're quite different in scale. I mean, one, maybe she's going to serve brunch at the Southern Cross and then go do dinner service at Jonathan's.
I guess
she's
so.
She's going to have a busy day.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, like, again, there's... If you're just going to talk about, like, unanswered questions, it's like, again, you could look at this movie and be like, is the crab Gene O'Reilly? Is the crab her mom? Is Gene O'Reilly an angel? Is he a ghost?
So,
did he really know her mother? Betty Buckley seems to think he did not.
I re-listened to the How Did This Get Made episode about this movie just to kind of remind myself some other ideas. And June, God bless her, was convinced that the spirit of her mom was inside the crab.
I think you could walk away from the movie thinking that.
That is a valid takeaway. And I can see why she would think that.
And it's one of those insane things, too, because, again, the crab doesn't matter. Like, so much of the movie, you don't even deal with the crab. And then when you cut back to him hanging around in the kitchen, you're like, oh, right. And then you also see him, and Sarah Michelle Gellar's like, oh, boy, this guy up here. Am I right? So it's like, you know the crab is just hanging around on the shelf covered in lettuce, and you're just sort of like... What are you going to do, kitchen crab?
Is this like, I mean, I don't know. Is this like some sort of lobster-esque world? Or was that movie The Lobster?
The Lobster.
Yeah.
Where her mother was turned into a crab for not finding true love.
For not finding true love.
I mean, if this was like The Lobster, I mean, that's an example of like weird dreamlikeness done very well and effectively, in my opinion.
Isn't that a grim...
Oh, yeah, it's a dystopic movie.
No, I'm just saying, yeah, but you would never...
Why would you want to live in this society?
Even if reincarnation, why crab?
Why lobster? Yeah.
You could become a stupid, repulsive anteater.
Ugh, fucking hate anteaters. Oh, I hate them.
Fucking hate anteaters.
So, I guess, briefly, let's just tap on the characters and the actors. There's not a whole lot to go into here.
God, I don't like anyone.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree.
There are two people I like.
There are also two people I like.
All right, so first up... Well, yeah, okay, that's certainly true. So first up, I would say we've got Sarah Michelle Gellar as Amanda.
She's given some tough fucking lines to sell, man.
She does not succeed.
Yeah.
Look, Buffy is a very important show to me, and she is very good on it, but this does not play to her strengths.
Right.
And
I mean,
also she was not being directed by
anybody. I was going,
there's
was
that.
Sane.
Yeah.
And
she has a terrible screenplay to work with.
Yeah.
I mean, my question that I asked you is just like, is Sarah Michelle, as someone who's never watched Buffy, doesn't care about Buffy, is Sarah Michelle Gellar a good actor?
Yes.
Okay. Is she an actor who's good in certain things?
She might be somebody who's good in certain things.
Yes.
Because I feel like the only things I've seen her in small parts, right? Like, I know Scream 2, where she has, like, two scenes.
I guess my question would be, how are we judging good? Am I saying that she's good in everything? No. But when she is good, she's very good.
See, that's why I would say she's somebody who is good in when utilized in certain ways.
Okay. And, like, I liked her in Southland Tales, which we watched, but that's sort of a hard barometer assess someone.
I mean, like,
although,
I think she's fun and Cruel Intentions, but I would not say she's good because that movie
is kind of bad across the board.
I love it, but
it is
not.
Right, and that's the thing. And, like, I've only ever really seen her in, like, those things, and I think I Know What You Did Last Summer, which is not a movie I like, so it's hard for me to look at that movie and say, oh, she is a good actor, because I just don't think the movie's that good.
What are you waiting for?
Yes.
That's not even her. That's
Jennifer Love Hewitt. Jennifer Love Hewitt.
That's just what I remember from I Know What You Did Last Summer.
But anyway,
I've never seen Sarah Michelle Gellar or anything.
I think there's very possible you might not have.
Except
I've
Southland
seen
Tales.
Yeah, Southland Tales.
Where she was directed by a crazy person better than...
Yeah, to winning effect.
Yeah.
She was The Rock's girlfriend who did the Teen Horniness Is Not a Crime song.
And she was also like, she had like a talk show of all porn actors just like discussing world issues.
Yeah, like world topics,
I mean, I don't... It was not a good introduction to her in as much as I didn't remember her being in Southland Tales. And I think it's... early on in the movie, I just said, I don't like her face. And it took me a while to put together that it's the... I don't know. The, like...
Her look is too cutesy for you.
It's a cutesy look, and the type of, like, faces she's making to play this kind of ingenue, like, young, naive character.
Yeah.
She does make a lot of the similar faces on Buffy, though. I just think it is utilized to better effect, and she just has better material.
But isn't she, like, killing vampires in that show?
Yeah.
She can't be that cutesy.
She's
all the
cutesy girl who's killing vampires. That's kind
That's
of
the whole
point.
Joke.
It's like she's cheerleader, but also she kills vampires.
Yeah.
Okay.
The thing that I would throw out there just as a real quick addendum.
Unimpressed.
We had mentioned previously that
I'm not impressed.
Holly Hunter was originally supposed to play this part.
Would have been so interesting.
And they said
to
too
see.
Old.
And they said too old, so they said fine, Sarah Jessica Parker, and they said still too old, despite the fact that again, this was during peak Sex and the City, when one would think that Sarah Michelle Gellar in a low budget romantic comedy would be a pretty safe bet.
Although, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah, sorry, Sarah Jessica Parker would be a pretty safe bet in a low budget rom com. Did not take, so they went with Sarah Michelle Gellar because Buffy was popular at the time.
Even though this is like so completely a different
Right, genre. And that's the thing too. If you think about this as a character written for a character who is, say, in their 40s, who is sort of dealing with the burden of their parent having died and perhaps they didn't have their own life to live and they've sort of felt the pressure of dealing with this restaurant and now their parent is gone and it's up to them and you're just sort of like, I haven't lived my own life. I don't know anyone. All I have is this restaurant. My mother's not even here to tell me how to do it anymore. I feel so much pressure from all this. That's something. It's so different when it's a 21-year-old, which I believe is what Sarah Michelle Gellar is in this movie, playing this part. It feels like they did not find a good hook when they rewrote this character to be a younger character.
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah.
But my question is, like, when it's someone who's... I guess it depends on, like, the context of where the character's coming from. Because when it's somebody in their middle ages, it's like, my mom owns a restaurant. And now she's dead. Were you... You were around that for, like, your whole life.
Right.
And you never...
I mean,
and you never said, like, this isn't for me, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that when the character was in her 40s that... The setup was exactly the same.
Yeah, there might have been some... So, yeah, I can't speak
like,
to that. Really.
It would make sense if it was, like, somebody who... Like, if it was, say, it's Holly Hunter, and, like, maybe she, like, ran away younger or, like left because she was, like, I can't... My mom's investing too much in her customers and her restaurant and she doesn't have time for me, and I'm...
She spent so much time making this martini machine.
I resent the restaurant, and I'm going to go do something wildly different from cooking. And now she has to come back and deal with the restaurant. And there's some sort of thing in the will about her having to, like, make a go of it or something.
Sure.
That would make some kind of sense because there's, like... She doesn't know how to cook, but otherwise it's like, you must know how to run a restaurant to some extent, a little bit. Your mom did it her whole life. You had to have, like, grown up as a teenager and worked part-time in the restaurant.
Yeah.
You must know some basics of cooking. If it's a 20-something, I get more that, like, oh, I'm completely unprepared for any of this.
Yeah, I mean, you would need to have some explanation as to why that was the case. But I do think the point that I'm taking away, I think, is just that it's different to be a 21-year-old woman who's like, I've never felt love before.
Yes.
Versus being a 40-something-year-old woman who's like, I feel like I've never connected with a guy once in my entire life.
Yeah, I think it's, like, different emotional stakes, but I feel like narratively it's a vastly different setup.
Sure, yeah. I can only assume that you would need to do some work to make sense of that.
It would probably be, like, if it was Holly Hunter, it's, like, there's some other issue that's with the building or, like... Oh, our food's just not clicking with people and they're not showing up, or, like, it's technically good, but it has no heart and soul and flourish.
Right,
in it.
And I think it could even just be, you know, again, the problem here just seems to be that Sarah Michelle Gellar is not a good cook for the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
So, like, that could be it. It's just, like, this is not my skill set, you know? Like, I think it's one thing to be, I know how to run a restaurant. I know the basics involved of keeping a business afloat. I can't be a cook, though. My mom was the cook, and now, like, you think I'm expected to be the cook? I can't do that.
But also, like, she has a sous chef.
So right,
why
so
can't
I
she
know.
Just run
right.
the restaurant and let Nolan cook.
Right, yeah, there's just, I don't know, man. These people don't fucking know how to run a business. Maybe Tom needed to come in and tell them that.
He'd be like, you've got mail, and actually the corporate takeover is, like, pictured as a good thing.
Yes. if anyone, anything else for SMG?
No.
No? Okay.
Submachine gun?
Yeah, exactly. My favorite. So next up we have Sean Patrick Flannery as Haircut.
Snooze.
He is awful in this.
Yeah.
Like, I hate
snooze.
Every line delivery. I hate his face.
He's boring. He's
Lee
a dick.
Sarah Michelle Gellar's face. Like.
Yeah. A very, very uncomfortable to watch makeout scene between the two of them.
Yeah.
Oh, didn't it sort of seem like they were, like, that was the first time they had ever touched each other? Because there was, like, a weird gingerness, and, like, I noticed when they leaned into, because I was watching for it this time, because I thought I noticed it the first time I watched, when they lean into kiss, there's, like, a weird, there's a couple of moments where they're, like, like, they're just, like, not sure, don't want to. It's very odd. Like, they almost, like, were repelling each other a little bit.
I don't know. I wasn't paying attention to the makeup.
You weren't really looking at that?
You were not analyzing and taking notes.
Sometimes I do watch. I'm not, like, averse to watching it, but I wasn't particularly noticing it. I'm also probably not the best judge.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But, no, I agree wholeheartedly that he does scream, like, get him on a basic TV.
Very Hallmark leading man vibes, where just you just need someone who looks like a JCPenney model.
He's just so much more, like, negative and dickish than you need this character to be.
Yeah,
also,
I mean,
they try to make him quirky and...
With the paper airplane.
Well, the paper airplane's at least... Okay, so I talked about this, too. The paper airplane thing bugs me a little bit, because in the beginning, he sets up this idea that... Who was it?
Howard Hughes,
thank you.
Yeah.
Flew a paper airplane, like, 4 miles or something in Las Vegas. And he wants to someday break that record. So at the end of the movie, whenever he sees Sarah Michelle Gellar running away in a cab, he opens his window, throws a paper airplane down, it falls into the cab, and she sees it and gets up and looks at him. Would not it make a lot more sense and be a lot more in touch with the magic realism ideas of this movie if she got back to her apartment, to her restaurant, and the airplane that he throws out the window magically flies longer than whatever that distance was and hits her or something? Or
I guess, but it would be bonkers for him to think that that's going to happen when he...
No, I know. I agree. I mean, I feel like there might be some sort of weird way where you can do it where...
He's just believing in magic.
Like, yeah.
Isn't there like a Pixar short that's about like paper airplanes
there is. Yeah.
flying around?
They're Paperman, I believe it's called. I think it's a Disney short technically. But yeah. So there is that. The other thing that I find strange that you are introduced to almost immediately as his character quirk is that he has... charts showing that after the third date, no woman wants to be with
him. And it doesn't come back.
Right, no, that's the thing too. Like you, so I guess like maybe what you're supposed to get from this guy's clinical and analytical, and you know, he has a spreadsheet where his heart should be or some shit like that. But you would think this would matter in some way where throughout the entire movie, he's approaching this relationship using like analytics and data, and Sarah Michelle Gellar is just like, hey, use your heart, like flow with my feminine energy that apparently is.
Let me flow with
And he's like, no, I'm binary, 10100010.
Polynomial.
Yes.
I mean, I think they do kind of pay lip service to it because they do say something about like, oh, this is a fourth or fifth date problem or something.
Right,
but,
yeah, that's
like,
true.
It is not a consistent or thought out theme.
Right.
Much like everything.
Right, as with a lot of this movie, it's a gimmick that's not well integrated in any meaningful way. But yeah, I really got nothing to say about him. They have negative chemistry in this movie.
Yeah.
It's really just, there's nothing happening
God,
there.
It's so fucking way off from any kind of relation to digital, you have no idea.
I just
looked up what polynomial was.
It's a math term.
It is a math term. It's a mathematical expression.
Yeah, that has really nothing to do.
Constants and coefficients.
Yeah. Yeah, that is not at all relevant to the discussion that he was having about binary.
So can we at least just talk briefly about the two people?
Well, okay, yeah. Next would be Patricia Clarkson as Lois.
She's one of mine.
Who's delightful.
Yeah, who's fucking great in this
movie. I genuinely think she is good in this,
yeah.
despite the fact that she's spouting nonsense.
This is insane. It's going to sound insane, but when I first saw her in the first scene that she's in, I was like, oh, it's his mom.
That's
not insane.
I was going to say, they do have a sort of... She does have a maternal energy toward him.
She does, but she's like, probably not the mom.
I was going to say, no, it is... Actually, I am curious.
I think that just goes to, again, we were kind of talking about how Patricia Clarkson has a mature look to her.
Yeah, she is 6 years older than him.
6 years.
Which is insane. We're not saying this is an insult. She's beautiful, but
she
has always had...
She honestly looks way hot in this movie.
Right, no, she is. She's fucking hot as hell. But she has always had sort of the bearing and energy of a very mature older woman who, like, knows what she fucking wants, has her life completely together.
I think She has like Glenn Close energy.
She does,
the other
right.
person who is just like
who has
very
always felt like
dignified
an older woman. Yeah.
and stately and.
Right.
But I could drink up every scene with her. I was like seated up a little bit or sitting up a little bit more. Again, like I love her playing. The physicality of her getting horny was so good. She looked amazing in that dress at the end.
It's just kind of like when you get Joan Cusack in or someone.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like, just one of those actors that? Who can do anything.
These people come to work.
Right. Yeah. Right. They will elevate the material yeah. just by force of will.
And she kind of has a little thing with Dylan Baker, who is my second person.
Yeah, he's also, yeah. I think, quite good in this.
He is.
Being spouting
he's,
nonsense.
Despite being insane, yeah.
He's honestly
yeah.
kind of, like, funny in this movie, which most characters are not successful at.
He's just
at
kind
being.
Of, like, having a lot of fun shooting some scenery.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
He's just kind of giving big...
I mean, he is supposed to be kind of, like, the weird rich guy.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
That, it does kind of work, so...
What was that, I want you to be in charge.
You to be the boss.
You to be the
yeah.
boss.
You can be the boss.
You yeah. can be the boss.
Yes. The thing that I find so very bizarre about his character, though, is
what
that
was
in
the cherry tartlet line.
You look like a sweet cherry tartlet. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's some other guy she's talking to who's just kind of standing there when he like sneaks up behind her.
Right.
And,
like, it's getting super horny with her. And, like, this other guy's in earshot. He hears
yeah.
what he's saying. But hey,
whatever.
We're all horny here at Benjamin's.
Yeah. Jonathan's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Because it's named after him. Yeah. So the thing that I find slightly weird about his character is that he is canonically the grandson of Henri Bendel, who is the proprietor, originator, founder of Bendel's, which is a
yeah.
real or was a real department store.
Oh, it's Henri. I didn't realize.
I think it's Henri.
Well,
I don't,
yeah, because
it's
I mean,
French
it
spelling.
Yeah,
so I assume
probably is Henri Bendel's.
Yeah,
but
anyways, he is canonically the grandson of this man. He seems to hate his grandfather because he talks about having a dream where he sees his grandfather's face in his shoes and getting angry at his grandfather's face, which is just such a weird ass swing to me. That one, a department store agreed to play itself in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people had to have read the script and be like, great, we're on board, let's roll with this. And the character who represents the store is like, God, I fucking hate the guy who owned this store.
Yeah.
Like, can you just imagine if, you know, like, you have a movie set in Macy's, and the guy's like, God, I fucking hate Macy's so
yeah.
much. I'm his great-great-grandson, and boy, he fucking sucked. I'd punch his
I
old face
Gerald
in.
I hate Gerald Macy.
Right. It's just, I don't understand so much of that. I want to know, why did Bendel's agree to be in this movie? What were they getting
maybe,
out of it?
Maybe they were on the way in. And this was some kashish they could make, like, you know.
I mean, they closed in 2019, so 20 years after this, but...
Sarah Michelle Gellar cursed them.
Maybe
yeah.
Yeah, this was the beginning of the end.
But I think, like, on IMDb, it says, like, they're the first... Like, this is the first, like, film production that was ever allowed to be inside the legendary Bendel's,
mm-hmm.
and... It's this.
And this? Yeah, you went with this?
Yeah, so it's like, I wonder if they paid a lot of money for product placement and that maybe ruined them.
I guess maybe. Maybe they just thought that, like, oh, it's Buffy. Buffy, kids love that. It's like, people will see
maybe,
Bendel's, I
maybe
guess.
Maybe when they did Bendel's, it was like, that. Maybe they signed on for the Holly Hunter version.
Yeah.
Or the Sarah Jessica Parker version, where it could be like, yes, we have this older, like, upscale...
Right, and
you
get,
know.
Like, the crossover Sex and the City, which
yeah.
is, like, very big in the sort of the New York shopping sort of
yeah.
thing. That makes perfect sense. And then
so.
Sarah Michelle Gellar shows up and like, oh.
Wah, wah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are other characters,
really.
But I don't know, like, Christopher Durang as Gene O'Reilly, who's
just there to be weird.
Bizarre, bizarre little character. Larry Gilliard Jr. as Nolan, the sous chef, just...
He doesn't have much
good,
to do.
And also, it's kind yeah. of a weird, like, quippy black man character that
well,
is very of its time.
Right, I mean, that's the thing, too, is he is a weird, I don't want to say sassy black man, because that's not the stereotype, really, but sort of,
no.
like, I guess, streetwise
yeah.
black man. But he's not a stereotype in the way that you might think he would be a stereotype. He's just... weird. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
he's not written as you would think two middle-aged white people would write a black guy.
I mean, they
he's
may
just
not
written
have...
as a complete strange lunatic.
I don't think they necessarily wrote his race into the script. I
no,
think
that's
they
probably
just happened
true.
To cast a black man.
Sure.
And then they only really acknowledge that when they put him in the bizarre, like, you know, askew do-rag. In the
right.
end.
And then there's Betty Buckley as the aunt, right?
Who barely matters,
yeah.
sadly. What a waste of Buckley.
I mean,
a
she's
woman
probably
who...
just like somebody who lives in New York and is a woman of a
right.
certain
I assume
so.
It's kind of just that. It's like, right, yeah, you need a woman, here she is. Having kicked around all that shit, let's take it to fixes. Does anyone want to start?
I can start.
Go ahead.
I want to keep the core idea of this being magic, food, magic kitchen, maybe putting emotions into it or, like, something like that. I like that. I even like the idea that it's a romantic comedy, but I need... What I'm going to add in, I think, is... We're just going to make it be, Mom was explicitly a witch. Maybe that's not something that our main gal knew,
but discovers when her drunk aunt, Betty Buckley, toddles in after another night of the food not going over well and being like, no, your mother wasn't even a good cook. She could just do magic. We can bring the crab back. I just would think...
Oh, thank God.
It would just be maybe more of a, like, when she's first starting out as a magic chef, she accidentally animates...
Conjures a familiar.
...a crab. But I would also maybe want there to be more of a direction. Like, I don't need any of the Bendel's stuff or the fancy restaurant stuff. That was kind of meaningless to me. What I would maybe prefer would be that he's maybe a restaurant critic or something like that that has... was, like, a huge fan of the restaurant when it was under her mom and is, like, disappointed to see this kind of fall with her and then is, like, really excited to see this come back. And you could even play a little bit of her trying to, like, hide the magic from him. But I don't know if I want to go in that direction necessarily because I do think the magical realism could be very fun in that situation and you would have to not acknowledge it in that case. But yeah, that's basically what I have. I would have just made it explicitly magic witch food.
Magic witch food.
I can go next. Yeah. Mine's of a similar ilk, but a little different direction.
Okay.
No crab. No. What is crab? Why is there a crab? It's confusing. It's weird. It makes no fucking sense. Her mom has passed away. She gets this restaurant. There is no, like, weird dude that sells crabs that she gets. There's no mysterious stranger. I think that... she gets this restaurant, she has, like, a staff, but the staff, I think, relied a lot on the direction of her mother. I think that, like, there was maybe, like, a refrain or some part of, like, there's some sort of thing from her childhood or something that her mother used to say about cooking, about, like, oh, you just have to, like, put your heart and soul into it. Some sort of kitschy, cliche thing, right?
She
that she would just kind of say.
A wooden sign on the wall from Target that said
Yeah, like, said something like that that she would say. That's kind of the only thing she has of, like, well, I don't know how my mom managed to, like, run this restaurant or cook all this stuff. And then I think early on she finds, like, a dusty old, like, cookbook in her mom's old bedroom or somewhere where, like, I guess she's probably meant to find it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her mom's cookbook, and it just has, like, stuff that was used as cooked in the restaurant. And that cookbook is, like, the thing that starts to unlock her, like, understanding of it. And I think that the inside cover has, like, that thing that she always used to say about cooking that's cliche. And it sounds cliche and kitschy, but it's also, like, the key of, like, you, that's how you do the magic with the food. You have to put your heart and soul into it. And so she starts inadvertently doing it, maybe some for some reason. Actually, yeah, let's have it before the guy. I think the guy in this movie is not, like, maybe he's a manager. I think he works for the department store. But he's not, like, the same guy at all. I think he's nervous, and he's got this, like, big thing coming up, and he knows he's got to, like, impress the owner with this, like, restaurant or this, like, charity event or this dinner that he's got to, like, be responsible for. And he's like, God, I need, like, caterers or blah, blah, blah. And maybe he's, like, a chronic overworker, and they end up at her restaurant and the breakup happens just naturally, but it's because she's like, you never have any time for me because you're always thinking about work. And he's like, of course I am. Work is important, blah, blah, blah. And then maybe she, like, overhears that he's, like, really stressed about this thing. And she's just, like, kind of naturally, like, worried about it. And she's like, God, I hope he figures this thing out or whatever and, like, cooks whatever the fuck he's supposed to be eating. And it gives him, like, a big confidence boost. And he, like, somehow remembers, like, this food was so great. It made me feel so good about the rest of my day. And I got so much work done after this. And I, like, made a lot of, like, good progress. And ends up hooking on the idea that, like, she has to be the one to, like, cook for whatever meal is, like, coming. Like, it's probably not like a restaurant opening, but, like, just, like, one dinner or whatever. And convinces her to do it, even though that's, like, kind of the first time she's cooked, like, a really good meal. And she does it. And she does impress the owner. And then the owner is like, you know what you should do? You should be, like, one of the chefs at our new fancy-ass corporate restaurant in our big corporate building with our department store. And she's like, oh, but I already, like, own, like, I have a restaurant or whatever. And now she's, like, dealing with this. And, like, her and, like, the manager character are, like, kind of hitting it off. And obviously he's, like, got a vested interest in, like, wanting to appease his boss. So he's trying to, like, maybe he's, like, caught in between of, like, I like this girl and I want to swear, but she obviously wants to be at this restaurant and not work for this, like, thing. And so there's, like, this weird tension of, like, where she's going to go. And I think in the meantime, she starts, like, there's a slow understanding of, like, her kind of helping people through problems at this restaurant. And they're kind of figuring it out together. And it's kind of like this, the main arc is, like, the two of them getting together and him battling, like, ambition for his work and trying to convince her that, like, well, if you went to the big restaurant, you just help more people because
right.
more people will go to the big fancy corporate restaurant. And then ultimately, the decision would obviously be that she has to keep her mom and pop corner store restaurant and help the commoners because obviously.
The commoners!
The rabble.
The hoi polloi. Because everyone else is going to be like rich fucks.
Do you think Southern Cross is right across from
the little shop around the corner?
And the diner from It Could Happen to You?
Yeah.
They're all on the same street, actually.
Yeah. So it would be that. It would be like, I think it was really weird that like she gets this job at this, like, that this thing comes up where she's getting a job at this big fancy ass restaurant, and it's like, you already own a restaurant.
Right, it's really never dealt with.
It's never
like,
dealt with.
No one ever says, like, what's going to happen to your other place?
And, like, isn't that bad? Like, don't you want to be, like, working at your mom's,
right.
Small business versus this awful
department store
like, fancy restaurant?
Yeah.
So that's what I would focus on.
So what I have for mind is that this is one of those weird movies where there are any number of themes you could take away from it and use to shape a movie around. I think the thing that I thought this movie was going to be about when I was first watching it is that it was going to be about how Sarah Michelle Gellar is in charge of her dead mother's restaurant, but is not a good cook and is not good at it and doesn't like doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what this should kind of be, and it's about the feeling of pressure of the burdens that are placed on you by your family or your parents or, the pressure that even like a dead relative could have on you for something like this. And I also thought this was going to be a theme because, again, this is something that Dylan Baker deals with in the movie too, where he's always talking about like, oh, fucking grandpa, I hate him so damn much. Oh, he's the worst. And so I feel like you would not be insane for watching this movie, seeing those two things and being like, oh, this is a theme that this movie is kind of running with. It's not. Apparently it's about mirrors and physics. But anyways, so what I think I would want it to be is just Sarah Michelle Gellar is now in charge of this restaurant with Betty Buckley. She is not feeling at all. She does not want to do it, but she sort of feels the pressure of having to keep this memory of her mother alive. It's sort of a You've Got Mail, except whereas that one, Meg Ryan loves her mom's bookstore. In this one, she's like, boy, this is an albatross around my neck. I do not want to fucking deal with this shit. And I think similarly, Haircut would be sort of reconfigured to be the Dylan Baker character, where he is the grandson of this New York department store scion, and he just feels the pressure of his family's name, of this sort of Macy's style department store where it's like, oh, it's a beloved New York institution. Everyone fucking loves it. It's like, that's your name on the store, man. How can you not want to be a proud part of this legacy? And he's just like, boy, I don't fucking love this at all. Maybe I want to make airplanes or some dumb shit. I don't know. I think the movie is sort of just about these two people coming together and sort of realizing that their interests lie elsewhere. And I think maybe at the end, it would sort of be down to Betty Buckley explaining to Sarah Michelle Gellar that, like, this is not something your mom would want to you. Like, I know you feel this pressure to keep this diner running, but, like, that's not what your mom wanted. Your mom doesn't want you to be fucking miserable. She would want you to be happy above anything else. So if that means getting rid of this place, then fine, get rid of
it. That's what it is.
Right. And I think that could also sort of come into play where then maybe Haircut is like, well, great, then do you want to come work at the fancy restaurant, my department store? She's like, I think you fucking hate your job too, dude. And he's like, oh shit, some therapy right there, and realizes that he in fact also hates his job. So it kind of ends with the two of them sort of being like, we have to kind of go chart our own ways. I think we have to sort of get out of the influence of our family sphere and sort of figure out who it is that we want to be.
Beautiful.
There it is.
I was sort of rolling with the idea of the character being more middle-aged, and I think in mind Patricia Clarkson is going to play the
yes.
lead. But it's not a restaurant, it's a bakery. And it was something that she owned with her husband, and they had run this bakery together. She, like, did the business, he did the baking, but he got sick. They had to close the bakery and put a lot of money into his illness, and then he passed away. So she is a widow, and she wants to reopen the bakery because it's the only thing she's ever done, and she wants to keep her husband's memory alive, but she's just simply not good at baking, and baking is hard. So she's going to try to make it work with, I guess, her sister, Betty Buckley, and also she has this cute young cashier that's going to be Sarah Michelle Gellar, and they're going to be trying to make this bakery work. She's going to meet some fop at the farmer's market who is, I think, going to inspire her with something, and meanwhile, her crotchety landlord, Dylan Baker, is threatening to shut her down. All of a sudden, after she meets this fop, her baking starts to get better, and people start to come to the bakery, and Dylan Baker starts to get won over, and it seems like maybe it's because of her
his
baking.
Last name.
Well, that could be too. Yes, magically, that's why he's intrinsically.
Is it called the Dylan
place.
Bakery?
It should be. And at one point, they're going to, like, have a fight and break up, and then things at the bakery, like, the food's going to start to get bad again. But meanwhile, Sarah Michelle Gellar and I think Sean Patrick Flannery is going to be, like, Dylan Baker's landlord assistant or something. And, like, they've had this meet cute, and they're kind of still going well. And then Patricia Clarkson and Dylan Baker are going to get back together. And the whole message is going to be something like, you know, maybe this isn't magic. It just sort of takes work and thought, which is kind of how baking is. Yeah. And it would be kind of this corny message, but I think this is kind of like a Hallmark movie at best sort of thing. But and I just, I like the idea of older people being the focus of something and also just... I just think it's a more realistic story for a romance, too. I mean.
Having covered all of this in detail, would any of us recommend Simply Irresistible?
No. Yes.
No.
I would only recommend it to people where I'm just like, you have to watch this in
season. Yeah, it is unhinged, so I'll give you that.
And it is at least short.
It is.
It doesn't really feel short, though.
It doesn't. It feels long.
Yeah. I will just say yes. I am not saying it is a good movie, but I do enjoy myself when I watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it, like, as a weird Wednesday, the week we had the blizzard, because I was doing themed nights again, and I was just like, well, that was definitely weird, and my mouth was just sort of hung agog the whole time.
It is a pretty unhinged movie, which I will give it that. All right, well, as always, dratpack.com is our website, our RSS feeds are working, so all the episodes are up on the standard podcasting apps or websites now, Apple Podcasts, Stitchy, Preems is dead, I think. Spotify, it's up there too. Spurtifer. And as always, you can check us out there. You can subscribe, you can rate, whatever it is that you want to do. And
we'll
be back in 2 weeks with a mini episode.
Au revoir, ZKs!